of her talk is the role of spirituality in a time of political crisis. So please welcome Kat.
I'm sure I'll trip on it. Good morning, everyone. Thanks for coming on early Sunday morning. So before I start speaking at you or with you, I actually want to do a short guided meditation just to bring us all in this moment, because I know we've left things behind. If any of you are preparing Passover like me, there's a lot that you're leaving behind that you need to pay attention to when you get back home. And so I'd like to just do a really short guided meditation to bring us here, so we're actually present for the next 45 minutes, an hour that we have together. So if you'd be willing to indulge me and close your eyes, take a few deep breaths. And what I'm going to invite you to do is to breathe into your body and fill your body up with any concerns, thoughts, or worries you have about anything you've left behind before coming here. Any interactions you had that maybe you want to let go of, any worries you have from before you entered this room. So if you could just breathe those in, fill up your body really, really full. And when you breathe out, just let it go. And go ahead and do it again. Breathe it in and fill your body up. Let it go. Take another deep breath. And now we're going to breathe in any concerns we have or things we're thinking about that we need to do after we're here today, because they'll still be there. They're not going anywhere. You'll be able to attend to them after you're here today. So go ahead and breathe those in and fill your body up with those. And the out breath, let it all go. And go ahead, do one more time. Breathe it in. And on your out breath, go ahead and let it go. Now shake your body a little bit. Feel yourself in your seat, your feet planted on the floor, your bottom placed in the seat, and really feel yourself grounded in your chair, on the cushion, wherever you're sitting. And now breathe in this moment, this present moment with this beautiful space, incredible view. Breathe this moment in, this space, this collective space of all of us together, and go ahead and breathe that in. Fill yourself up with this moment. And as you breathe it out, feel it fill you and sink you even more deeply into the present moment. And let's do that one more time. Go ahead and breathe it in. And as you breathe out, feel yourself land and arrive. Shake out anything else you need to let go of and feel yourself present. And go ahead and open your eyes when you're ready. Agree, those are fun to do. Thank you for indulging me. Yeah, is this not? Sorry. Yes. I will. One second. I will speak a little louder in one moment. As soon as this opens. Okay, cool. Good morning. Thank you all for being here today. So I'm going to share a little bit about my work, and I'm going to ground it in my spiritual tradition and practice a little bit to begin. And please, if you can't hear me either, just let me know or raise your hand, and I'll try to speak up. So we're entering the holiday of Jewish liberation, of Passover. And it's critical message that liberation is possible, a message that has led to the creation of a tradition of social change that runs counter to the dominant ideology of every class society, namely that fundamental reality cannot be changed, that nothing is actually stuck. Whatever it is that makes this change possible is what I see as Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh has been translated by Christians as God. So Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, if you just read any passages in the Torah or the New Testament as the that in the universe, that energy in the universe that makes possible the transformation from that which is to that which can and ought to be, that is our definition of God. It's a force in the energy of the universe, and it lives within each and every one of us because each of us has experienced dramatic change in our life. So we're celebrating that freedom through Passover with Seders on Monday and Tuesday nights in an 8-day process of really trying to focus on what it means to us personally and in our community to see that things can really change through our despair and through our internalized beliefs that nothing can be fundamentally changed. We engage in a process of envisioning that things can actually fundamentally change. This notion that the world can be fundamentally changed underlies the work of the Network of Spiritual Progressives, the NSP. We want the world to be changed and recognize the forces opposing that are immense, as they have always been in class societies. But the NSP is committed to looking at the big picture. Every time I look down, right? The NSP is committed to looking at the big picture and recognizing right now we need a fundamental transformation of our political and economic order. Not just small tweaks, not just resisting and holding back the tide of terror and change that we see coming, but actually putting forth a vision of a fundamentally, radically different world. There's always been this alternation between two sides of this ruling elite of this society. Both sides of elites want the fundamental unequal distribution of wealth and power to be maintained at some level. One side, we'll call that the Democrats, says that in order to maintain it, we need to give some degree of social support to people most badly hurt by the unequal distribution of wealth and power in this society. And the other side, we'll call that the Republicans, is unwilling to cut into its own wealth and power in any significant way at all. And they don't care about the future of the planet or the well-being of the people. So as spiritual progressives, we believe there needs to be a very different kind of worldview. And we start with a picture of what that world is. And we know that it will sound utopian and fantastical to people. And yet, actually, it is the only realistic way to save the life support system of the planet and to stop the endless alternation between two factions of the ruling elite in our society. Again, one who looks for some degree of compromise and one who simply doesn't. We're working for much more fundamental change. The fundamental change entails a new way of assessing what is important and valuable to people and building a movement based on that assessment. And that assessment is based on the work of the Institute of Labor and Mental Health, which is the parent organization for Tikkun magazine and the Network of Spiritual Progressives. And it's based on years of research that was done by the Institute of Labor and Mental Health into what it was that was causing working class people to move from the left to the right, even though their economic interests were clearly in the left. So what was it that was causing them nonetheless to support right politics, right politicians, and right positions, when in fact their economic needs were much more supported by the policies of the left? So that was what the research did. And what they found out is that people don't only vote based on the material needs. Don't only vote based on their material needs. That they also have psychological and spiritual needs, such as needs for love, for living in a world that feels just, for creativity, for having a sense of being valued. I always like to say for having a sense of being gotten, you know, that kind of somebody really understands you at a core level, for sense of belonging and community, for sense of being seen and respected simply for who you are, not for what you can produce or give to anyone else. And for being able to connect with this amazing universe with awe, wonder, and radical amazement, rather than as looking at it as something we can take from to meet our wants. So I'm confident that this resonates with the all of you here. and as it does with many religious and spiritual communities and secular humanists as well. And yet, even though this resonates with us and even though we want it so badly, it's not something we speak about that much, and certainly not something we speak about in the political realm that much. And I think it's because we think it's too unrealistic. It's too utopian, and it feels too spiritual to talk about in the political realm. And yet, ultimately, that's what we need to do. The definition of what is realistic is actually held by those who get to define our structures and systems in our society. In other words, the ruling elite. That is who tell us what is realistic in this society. And yet, it's only through the work of those who didn't believe in that that we've had the dramatic changes we've had over the past 50 years. It wasn't the realists who brought us abolitionism. It wasn't the realists who brought us LGBTQ rights and marriage. It wasn't the realists who ended apartheid or the struggle in India for independence. It was the idealists. It was those who believed that the world could be fundamentally and radically transformed. And that's why it's like so beautiful to be speaking about this on the Sunday before Passover begins, right? Because there was nothing realistic about the belief that the Jews could get out of Egypt, out of slavery. And yet they did. And so what these idealists did is they put forth a vision of the world that they want, not simply articulating what they are against. They actually advocated for it through efforts such as writing, as direct action, legislative efforts, lawsuits, consciousness raising. And with all those efforts, they transformed the view of what's possible in our society and in the world on all these different levels in ways people thought really that they were crazy until it happened. And you saw that with the gay rights movement. I was involved in that movement for many years as a lawyer. And the initial arguments were, we'll just go for civil marriage. And there was huge debates within the community. Should we go for civil marriage? Should we go for actual marriage? Should we just keep quiet and try to get some rights in the workplace? And there were people pushing the edge and saying, no, we want to go for full recognition as human beings of our dignity and our rights. And they were dismissed. People within their own community thought that they were wrong and it was going to be harmful to them. And yet they kept pushing this position and advocating for an entirely different vision of what was possible for them. And then in the brief that they wrote to the Supreme Court, it's an amazing, if you haven't read the Supreme Court opinion on this, it's a very beautiful, there's aspects of it that have a beautiful spiritual progressive articulation in the opinion. And it's only because somebody wrote a brief that Stevens could actually draw on to write the opinion. It wasn't like he downloaded this himself. There was briefs written that were grounded in the vision of a world based on loving kindness. The language of, we just want our families to have safety and security like your families. We love each other so much. Can't you appreciate that we want to be loved and included and belong just like you? That is not legal language, I assure you. There's nothing legalese about that. And yet that is how the movement for gay rights shifted from where it was to where it got to be, by helping people see the humanity and dignity of the people struggling and pushing for that humanity and dignity to be accepted and recognized in their communities and around the country and ultimately around the world. So that's what we need to do. I wrote an article about this that you can actually read. It's on our website at spiritualprogressives.org. On the landing, it's a new website, so please go check it out because it's really quite beautiful. But there's a section, Notes from the Spiritual Revolution, which are articles and blogs, and there's one that I wrote that calls Love Wins, which was an analysis of this very phenomenon that I'm describing right now. So what we need to do is to put forth a vision of the world that we want, even as it seems completely unrealistic. A vision that allows us to rise above the current discourse of how many small changes can we make, how many things can we hold back on, and instead offer an entirely different discourse. And that is what we call a world based on a new bottom line. So what is a new bottom line? A new bottom line says that instead of measuring the success of our social institutions, our economic institutions, our political institutions, our education system, our healthcare system, our legal system, our corporations, our politicians, based on the extent that they maximize money and power, the current bottom line, right? If you hear bottom line, that's what you think about. How do we maximize money and power? No, instead, we're going to measure the success of all these institutions to the extent that they maximize love and care, kindness and generosity, social, economic, and environmental justice, to the extent that they enable us and enhance our capacity to see one another as embodiments of the sacred, to truly respect each other and have dignity and see dignity in one another, and also enhance our ability to celebrate the awe, wonder, and radical amazement of this universe in which we live. Imagine school systems that actually were grounded in those values. Imagine corporations that were actually asking those questions. Imagine debates in legislatures that were asking, is this going to actually help us connect with each other and see the dignity in each other, or is it going to undermine our ability to do that? At all times in our society, we flow back and forth between fear and love. And what we're trying to do is push forth the social energy toward love and away from fear. And the only way to do that is to put forth this broader vision. Okay, so we at the Network of Spiritual Progressives have a three-stage strategy for how to overcome Trumpism. And the reason we say Trumpism is because Trump is just a manifestation of something we've been seeing unfolding over the course of decades. He just happens to embody it all in kind of one being. But his policies, his positions, what he articulates are things that have been said by people for decades on the right. So the first stage in our strategy is to train massive numbers of people in the skills of empathy and compassion, creating an empathy tribe. These are people who are then going to have the capacity to help transform the left. So why am I saying that? Because the left struggles. It has some challenges. And we want to help transform the left both by honoring all the amazing social justice efforts that they have engaged in over the years, all the successes, and also showing the left that it can benefit from integrating into its articulation of social justice a vision of the world that it actually wants, a vision grounded in ethical and spiritual values. Currently, the left focuses on what it's against. If you look at statements by left organizations, it talks about wanting to stop this, end that. It doesn't focus and articulate a shared vision of the world that we want. So Martin Luther King did not become an icon of social change by saying in his speech, "I have a complaint." He said, "I have a dream." And he articulated a dream that was so exquisite, so rich, so radical, so visionary that it reached beyond normal. It crossed over normal divides. So the next step is to help the left overcome its tendency to be demeaning and putting down of others who don't support their policies. So I'll stipulate that there are definitely some people on the right who are in fact racist, sexist, homophobic, anti-Semitic, Islamophobic, and, as the left often calls them, just plain stupid. But there are many who in fact aren't. In fact, most aren't. Instead, they are actually just people in profound pain in their lives. Many of them who are deeply disappointed in the Obama administration to come through with the policies that they needed to change their lives and alleviate their pain. And others are just so despairing of the political process, they see no point in getting involved or voting, or they just figured they would vote for Trump because something would have to change. And if you read articles about this and actually listen to what they're saying, this is exactly what they're articulating. And in our training, we actually read some of these, and then we do role plays where we practice giving empathy to that voice. Because this is actually what they're saying. So many are so fed up with being demeaned by the left. And you might remember in the elections when Hillary Clinton referred to a large portion of Trump supporters as a basket of deplorables. I mean, think about that for a minute. There's no recognition of people's humanity, of their suffering. They're just a basket of deplorables. It reminds me of when Madeleine Albright said, they're collateral damage. Right? It's like we've gotten to a discourse where people become characterized as throwaways rather than actually trying to understand and see them and connect with them in their pain. And this, it's not just Hillary who did this. I mean, this is all over the left. The left media, the left comedians, all of them just constantly putting down and demeaning, and it continues to this day. And the third thing that the left, we need to support the left with, is to overcome its spiritual and religious phobia that results in a failure to connect with or understand the genuine needs met by people who turn to spiritual and religious communities for a sense of meaning, purpose, belonging, and connection. The second stage, after we've worked on helping the left understand the ways it needs to change, is to then reach out across the divide to those who have historically supported the right or who don't vote because they feel so alienated and demeaned in a spirit of reconciliation and empathy. And this is the part that really gets people. The response I usually get is, wait a minute. They're the ones who are so awful. They're the ones who don't care about people. Why do we have to be empathic to them? And here's what I have to say to this, and I've done mediations for years in which I've heard this from people. You mean I have to be empathic again? He's a jerk. She's the idiot. Okay, all that may be true. But what we want to do is to transform people on our side. So it doesn't really matter if we're right. It matters if we're smart. So even if it's true, even if I grant that they are so awful in the policies and they treat people so terribly and I'm never going to talk to them, we'll stay where we are. And I don't want to be here much longer. It's not a very good world for most of us. So we have to learn to, I call it like the front burner and the back burner. Okay, when we both want to be heard and we both have needs, who gets to have their needs put on the front burner? Who has to hold theirs onto the back burner? Okay, so I'm saying right now that's our job. The left has to put our needs to be heard and understood on the back burner so that the people who are not with us can be heard first. And then we can start to bring our needs to the table. It may not be fun, but I think it's smart. And we need to reach out with empathy and to understand the fears and concerns that they have, and then to share our fears and concerns as well. We need to demonstrate that we actually genuinely care. This isn't a process of manipulation. I'm not talking about doing this to get our way. I'm talking about doing this to actually understand each other, to hear their needs and struggles, to express our needs and struggles, then to explore together what approaches and strategies we might use to get everyone's needs met. This is about building long-term relationships, not seeing them as commodities as they experience themselves being seen in the capitalist marketplace. As we deepen our understanding of one another, respect and trust grows. We become open to hearing views different than we've heard before, but not before that happens. And I'll just tell a brief story of this. Many years ago, I was teaching at a community college in Washington State in an area where there were lots of migrant farm workers. It was in a part of Western Washington. And there was a student in the class who came up to me after class and started talking to me about his father was a farm owner, had a farm, and so they worked on the farm, and they had migrant farm workers. And it was a day I think it was right after there was a massive migrant farm worker protest. So the highway was shut, the farms were shut, no work was being done. And so this young man was so enraged. I mean, he was so enraged that I honestly was afraid he would hurt somebody. Like, he had such a level of anger. He had no understanding about why people might actually be on strike and what they were struggling for. All he could access was his rage. And I ended up being in communication with him outside of the classroom for about 2 hours, in which I allowed him to express his rage. And when I responded and tried to reflect what I was understanding was important to him and what he was saying without escalating his rage, but just really acknowledging and hearing him, then I'd say, I'm wondering if you're open to hearing a different perspective. And then I'd share a little bit about my perspective of what I could imagine might be going on for people who would be protesting. And then he'd hear me, I mean, literally at first for like 30 seconds, maybe a minute was how much he could hear. And then he'd go back into his attacks and his anger and his rage. And I'd stay with him and give him some more empathy, and then I'd share again. And after two and a half hours, I finally felt like, okay, he's not going to hurt somebody. and that maybe he heard a little bit of what I said. Now, I have no illusions that he then transformed and went home and told his dad or any of that, because he goes back to his home where he needs to be loved and accepted by his dad. And the way he's going to get loved and accepted by his dad is by agreeing. And so he's going to be re-fed the stories that he was told. But for a moment, we crossed that divide. If I had continued in a longer, you know, at teaching at that school for many years, which I didn't, maybe, and he continued to take classes with me, maybe he would have seen there were other ways to be in the world. But for a brief moment, he crossed and was able to hear something different that he never, ever heard before. And that was simply because I stayed in connection with him for so long that he was able to have a sense of being heard, and his whole energy field was able to calm down enough. So this effort to reach across the divide can be done in various ways. It can be done just in a simple way like I did, meet somebody on the street, talk to them. Or as a woman in my training recently told us in Canada, a Muslim woman who wears a hijab, so you know she's Muslim, was sitting in a cafe in Canada, and she was sitting behind a table or next to a table where they were talking about Muslims and less than sweet ways, let's say. And she was in the training where I'd been teaching about the new bottom line, and she thought to herself, I've got to embody this new bottom line right now. So this young woman stands up, she goes over to this table, and she says to them, would you be willing to let me sit down and talk with you? And she proceeds to talk with this table of people who had just been insulting and demeaning Muslims. And at the end of the conversation, one of the older men at the table the way she describes it, had been kind of looking at her and standoffish and not opening up at all, said to her, you remind me of my grandmother who used to wear a scarf over her head. And so these opportunities to reach across the divide can happen in the smallest ways. And those are sometimes the most powerful ways. They can also happen in listening circles, in community centers, in religious and spiritual communities. We're looking into and thinking about initiating a summer initiative in 2018 for a summer of love, justice, and environmental awareness, where people who are trained in these skills actually go out and meet in communities to bring these ideas into those communities. So the reason that's the second stage, though, and this is important, because the tendency is going to be to jump to reaching across the divide. But as long as the left continues to demean and put down people who aren't with them, then the minute people open up their hearts, if they then in the media or with other people that the left that they speak with hear the demeaning language, they're going to shut down and they'll never come back. So that's why it's important to help the left understand where it's missing the mark, if you will, in being opened and receptive to people who are not with them. So then once we've achieved those two goals, this is obviously a long-term journey. I always think about the people who first started the abolitionist movement. What was the first door they knocked on asking them to hang a lamp outside? And how many times were they unsuccessful on that journey? And how many years did it actually take? So once we achieve these two goals, without backing any particular party or candidate, at least we can't because we're a nonprofit, we then enter into struggling for actual fundamental change, for policies and movements that align with these values, that seek to actually change the way people engage in political struggle, so that they can be more effective in achieving, through democratic processes, the kinds of transformation we all desperately yearn for. If we shape our approach by the changes articulated in the first two steps that I described, we have a possibility, a really strong possibility of achieving the dramatic changes that have been deemed unrealistic within a decade or two. And that would include, and this is what we really need, right? Electing truly progressive leaders who really are willing to fight for truly radical transformation rather than piecemeal steps, tweaks to the system, as Rabbi Lerner likes to say, that so that we can all get our nose in the trough fighting for the little scraps that are being left behind. So we need a movement that is visionary. As I mentioned before, Martin Luther King didn't say, "I have a complaint," right? He said, "I have a dream." But most social change organizations struggle for what they are against. That's what they articulate. And this is even more so now, given what we're seeing by the Trump administration and by the right, right? We have to resist. And that resistance is critical. And articulating what we are against isn't wrong in and of itself. But in addition to articulating what we are against, we need to articulate and include in it a vision of a world based on a new bottom line. I always envision like this constant assaults that come at us, and we're treading water just to keep our head above water. Imagine if we actually lifted ourselves out of that process and put forth a vision and what that would do. The other thing we need to understand is that, as I mentioned earlier, people are struggling with not only with suffering from material needs, but from psychological and spiritual needs that aren't being met. And so that's another thing that the left fails to articulate, that we really need to articulate, and to articulate in an effective way. And so I think, what time is it, 10? What, I have like 5 more minutes? 5 more minutes? 20? 20 more minutes, but 15 minutes for questions. So, okay. So I'm just going to briefly tell you about two concrete proposals. They're in the brochure, but I'm just going to briefly tell you about them, that we articulate as a way to embody the new bottom line in actual proposals. Because when I talk about the new bottom line, often people say, well, how do you measure that? How do you put that into place? And those are all questions that we can talk about. But we also have two concrete proposals that are actually like real, like read more like legislation and things that we're comfortable with. And so the first is the Environmental and Social Responsibility Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And what these proposals do is they take the new bottom line, these values and visions, and put them into policies and proposals so that they're infused with these values. So the ESRA has 3 provisions. First, it states that all elections on the federal and state level be publicly funded. No private monies whatsoever. Second, it requires that all corporations with incomes of $50 million or more a year get a new corporate charter every 5 years. And to obtain that corporate charter, they have to prove a satisfactory history of environmental and social responsibility to a jury of ordinary citizens who can hear testimony from people throughout the world. And third, it directs that all schools at all ages, from kindergarten through professional and technical schools, teach values of sensitivity to the planet, ecological sustainability, compassionate and empathic communication, nonviolence, and civic engagement. The first two provisions, so I'm just going to briefly tell you how the ESRA is infused with the values of the new bottom line, because people always ask me that. The first two provisions embody the values that all people have in their inherent value and wealth, worth, excuse me, and that they can contribute to, those are Freudian slip, right, and participate in assessing the needs of individuals, of the society in which they live, of the planet, and of the world. That those decisions actually don't need to be left to the ruling elite. They also incorporate the values of the sacredness of the planet and provide people a mechanism to testify about the impact of a corporation on their community, on their lives. So just imagine a jury trial in which questions about the sustainability of threatened plants and animals are discussed, in which testimony is provided about the working conditions of people across the world, and about the impact of a company's practices of disposal of its product waste on children and elders in that community, in which evidence is presented about the impact of the company's advertising and the practices on women and people of color. Do the company's policies and practices lead to enhancing respect and dignity of all peoples, or does it perpetuate stereotypes that lead to violence and dismissal of the dignity of some? Jury trials such as these would necessarily lead to conversations in society about how we want to live, what type of world we want to engage in, and how we want to treat one another. These are fundamentally ethical, spiritual, and moral questions. They are not questions we normally hear engaged in our legal system. Trust me, I've been involved in it for many years. And they will enhance our ability to integrate spiritual and ethical values into our corporate and political world. The other proposal is our Global Marshall Plan. Global Marshall Plan is a vision of homeland security that is achieved through government policies of generosity and care for the well-being of others, rather than through strategies of domination and power over. So we believe homeland security can be achieved through generosity, through actually helping people both in our own country and around the world have the resources they need to have adequate education and health care, to have a good environment, to have sustainable policies. And so what we propose is that all industrialized nations would donate 1 to 2% of their gross domestic product for the next 20 years to reshape and repair the harm that has come from long-term policies of neglect and aggression towards inner cities and communities, both here and abroad. And we're not talking about giving this money to governments of these other countries. We're talking about giving it to the civic societies, the nonprofits, the people in the local communities who have actually been doing the work to make their communities that are sustainable, communities that are caring, communities that are respectful, and treat each person in that community with dignity and care. So the goal of the NSP is to build a massive spiritual movement of people who actually want a world that is radically different, not just tweaking what we have. And so I've been leading a training, and Dick mentioned that, and the one sheet paper that's over there that some of you have kind of is a brief description of that training. You can sign up for it to get more information of when I'll be leading the next training. I'm just ending this round, but I've been leading this training. We started these trainings actually before Trump, but now we've hone them in a bit, but for people on really how do you become part of a spiritual activist social change agent, and how do you understand the social and spiritual and psychological crisis in society and speak to that and speak to the needs that people have so that we really can get to a place where we have massive, we have like 70, 75% of the population supporting these ideas, and we can elect truly visionary leaders and put forth truly visionary policies. So I think I'll end there and open it up to questions. Thank you all so much.
Thanks. I have a microphone, so I will recognize people, and Ray is right here and gets the microphone.
Every day or every week, there's a convention of fantasy fans somewhere in the United States. And they think that the convention is a failure if less than 1,000 people turn up. And they're selling something that the left and the right can both buy, and that is the myth of the transformation of the outsider. Harry Potter begins as an orphan who's living under the stairs in a conventional household, but he goes to a special school and becomes a wizard. And Clark Kent is a mild-mannered reporter who actually secretly is Superman. And that is a vision of self-transformation that the public on the right and the public on the left will buy.
So, thank you for that. I appreciate that. So one of the things I talk about is Moses. Moses is raised in Pharaoh's home, and he goes out and he sees an Egyptian taskmaster kill a Hebrew slave, and he then kills the Egyptian taskmaster, and then he has to flee. And what happens to Moses at some point after being in the suburbs, if you will, in his comfortable life? He has an awakening, described in the Torah as a burning bush. The burning bush is that force in the universe that makes transformation possible from that which is to that which ought to be, that lives in each of us and lives in the world. And it's a bush that burns in us that says each of us can and need to be Moses. Each one of us has to find that burning bush within us to light us up to get engaged to change the world. So, I agree.
Yeah, right here.
Yeah, hi.
Hi. So this Saturday, April 15th, there'll be a pro-Trump rally in Civic Center Park in Berkeley. And there'll be a counter-demonstration of leftists, anti-fascists, trying to shut them down. And the last time, March 4th, that this happened, there was, you know, knockdown, drag-out, ongoing violence. Mm. So we're taking, actually, the empathy tent, and we're going to be setting up and offering empathic listening. And so I wondered if you'd like to come.
Beautiful.
And also, what do you think of that kind of a drama like out on the streets, there's the pro-Trump, anti-Trump folks, and that whole drama and how to kind of step into that with empathic presence and how to transform that. And we're trying to do it with an empathy tent.
Right.
And just wondering what you think of the whole kind of drama of it.
So I think you said it was on a Saturday, right?
April 15th.
Is that Saturday? Yeah, I do Shabbos on Saturday. It's my day off of all of this, so I can't join you. But what do I think of the drama? I mean, I think that it's an expression of people's pain, right? On both sides, right? There's this expression that's coming out so dramatically and so powerfully of the angst and sorrow that people are living with. So the question becomes, how do we engage with that in the healthiest way? So I think of when I've mediated family divorce, you can't really get a much more intense circumstance. And the question is, how do you simultaneously hold both of that intensity? And I think it's easier in a mediation office with just me and two clients because I can control it a bit more. But there's a need for people to be heard. So how might we do that in a situation like that? We might do it by saying, okay, let's get an empathy circle for the Trump supporters, and let's get an empathy circle for the non-Trump supporters, and start with separate empathy circles so that each group feels genuinely heard. And then maybe at some point there might be some people in each group who could come together into a circle where they can then hear one another, facilitated by very skilled people who can manage their own emotional triggers to hold that space. So that's just one I'm thinking out loud. But I think given the intensity, and the numbers, you can't do it simultaneously. It can't be like a couple people jumping back and forth. You actually have to give adequate space and time for each group to be genuinely heard. So I would say separate the groups and do 20 minutes of empathy with each group until you see the energy calm down enough, and then find the people in those groups who you think have the greatest emotional capacity and skill to come together.
Well, we'll have a row of chairs facing. Well, we'll have a row of facing chairs, and then we'll just be offering listening to whoever wants to.
Yeah.
That's a first step.
Yeah, that's a great first step.
Yeah,
it's a great first step. I look forward to hearing how it goes. Good luck. Yeah, good luck.
I have a couple of comments. You want to create change, but our study of how changes happen don't happen quite the way you're trying to get it to happen here. And so this is a suggestion. If you want change, if the Women's March, for example, will have absolutely no effect in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
However, it could have a positive effect if it's carried on into creating strong power groups that will continue to act together with politicians. Now, the masses, like us, we don't count. We don't create change. It's rare. We did it in the Vietnam War. We did it in civil rights. But that's only two major things that have happened in the centuries or so. So if you want to create change, what I suggest you do is look at the studies that have been done on how our society actually makes political change. And one of the things is you always enlist the aid of those who are rich, who you are having problems with. I do, too. And you also do it on a continual basis, and you create a relationship with the politicians who are active in the areas that you have of interest. And then once you develop that relationship and you create a platform, what you want to say, then they'll start to listen to you, especially if you create large numbers of voting people.
Mm-hmm.
So from a pragmatic point of view, I just have a few suggestions.
Thank you. Thank you.
John, I'm coming your way, and while I'm walking over there, I just want to mention to those of you who hadn't seen it that what Kat had referred to is up at the table here is a brochure about the Network of Spiritual Progressives, and there are also some books here that Michael Lerner has written called The Left Hand of God, Taking Back Our Country from the Religious Right. It's a little bit more important now than it was when he wrote it, probably.
I don't know if it was more important now. It's just become more prophetic now than it was when he wrote it in 05. I really suggest you read that book if you haven't. It's rereading it now, it's a little disappointing that no one took it as seriously, even though it was a national bestseller back then, because he spoke to this very issue then. So if you haven't read it, I encourage you to pick up a copy. There's also a sign-up sheet. Would you be willing to just circulate that? If you want to learn more about what we're doing or get on our mailing list, you can just sign up with your name and email, and then you'll get email information about what we're doing. Thank you. Yeah.
I remember when I first became aware of listening to the radio, and there would be people come on like Rush Limbaugh and Michael Savage, and then Fox News came on television, and my very initial reaction was, oh, this will be a good opportunity to hear what they have to say. But I just found it so venomous, I cannot listen to that. I cannot be empathetic with that. I will not listen to it. It's just like poison.
Yeah.
Why try to listen to it or be empathetic with it? It just doesn't make any sense.
So I think what I'm distinguishing between is between people like the small percentage that are like that and the larger percentage who voted who aren't actually racist, sexist, homophobic, etc. That we really need to distinguish and split between those two groups.
But
and so
that's
what I'm proposing.
They have more listeners and viewers than people who have the more progressive views like we do.
Right.
And maybe that's because of corporate sponsorship. I don't know. But it's not like they're just a little tiny minority.
No, I still think that we can work to slowly split them off. But, yes, it's. I wouldn't suggest if you can't do it, don't do it. Yeah, I hear you.
Hi, my name is Linda. So I was reading the Global Marshall Plan.
Mm-hmm.
So if we have 1% to 2% of the GDP dedicated to eradicating poverty, homelessness, etc., How is that enforceable? How is that going to become accountable? There's a lot of countries that are in turmoil. It's hard enough to get food and medical supplies there.
Right. So those are questions that would come up through the implementation of it and creation of it. We don't profess to have all of the answers to those questions. We're putting this out there as a vision and proposal to even move the discourse in that direction. Because that discourse isn't even on the table. It's not even something that's discussed. It's like, oh, this is happening. We'll go bomb there and we'll go bomb there and we'll invade there and we'll drop drones there. Continuing, whether you're in the left or the right, the discourse that our security will come through domination and power over rather than through generosity. So the proposal is an idea of how to actually start the discourse in that direction. And then, you know, if in 5 years, God willing, right, we get to the place where this is a discourse, then there'll be those kind of implementation questions.
Thank you for speaking today. I really appreciate your remarks. I wanted to share a little personal anecdote that I had last fall when I retired early to go back to Iowa to canvass for Hillary. Mm. And my first day out, I was in Des Moines, and I was in what you would call a marginal area, you know, mixed. And I knocked on this door of kind of a rundown fourplex, and a black gentleman about my age came out. We started talking, and he said, well, I'll probably vote for Hillary, but, you know, Obama didn't do enough for us. And I found that really interesting. I kind of understood what he said, but in my mind I'm thinking, well, you know, he's president for everybody. So he can't necessarily, you know, just focus on one particular faction, in this case, you know, the black people of our country and their problems. Then the man's son came bounding up the steps, and he goes, I'm voting for Trump because I want the revolution to start sooner. And that really pulled me up short that I live in this bubble, right, you know, out here in California in the Bay Area and Berkeley. And I've thought about it a lot, and I really think some of your remarks address that, that it looks like they're voting against their own interests. However, they don't see that they're getting a share of the pie. I mean, the 1% is now becoming like, what, the 0.5%. And the rest of us are still kind of scrabbling for the bottom part of it. And I still think about it. I haven't really figured it out. I've read Hillbilly Elegy. But I still ponder that a lot. There's something deeply psychological that we're missing here. Yeah. And I think the empathy idea and your idea of trying to, you know, reach across and just maybe get one little tiny idea across and then hopefully build from there makes more sense.
So the training really goes into much more depth than I could today about the psychological and spiritual suffering and includes readings and information so that we can really understand that, which will help us build this movement. So
even though I'm passing the microphone, I'm going to hold on to it for a second, and I'm going to ask my question, which if I were sitting down, I would be wanting to ask. So, you're speaking to a group of people, many of whom have difficulty with the concept of spirituality, some of whom are atheists, some of whom are agnostics, some of whom are just anti-religious. So could you just say a couple of words at the ending of what you and the Network of Spiritual Progressives mean when you use the word spirituality?
Sure. Yeah. So this is actually right on our website because that's a question a lot of people have. What do you mean by spiritual? I'm not spiritual. So if you believe in a world based on a new bottom line, you're a spiritual progressive. So it's not about believing in a God or about meditating every day or practicing a religion or it is absolutely inclusive of secular humanists and atheists. And we have, I'd probably say most members are in fact secular humanists and atheists. But there are people who connect to a dream about a different kind of world, a world that is, in fact, loving and care, kind and generous, that actually allows us to treat each other with actual respect and dignity, to see the beauty in each other's faces, and to recognize that you're worthy just because you are, without any demands or anything placed on you. That's what we mean. And that you, like, look outside at this view. I was married out there not that long ago, a couple years ago now. And just look out there. It's amazing, right? So we just take the time to just be in awe of something that we can't really completely understand. And yet it enriches our lives. And so we want to sustain it.
Okay. Well, this has been the last question. And
such a good ending.
I want to, since I still have the microphone, say to Kat, thank you.
My pleasure.
And hopefully we will see you again and often.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, what, I mean, these are wonderful ideas you're talking about, and what have you seen so far in terms of change, or, you know, actual change?
In terms of towards these proposals?
Yeah.
So, slow change, because we're so steeped in believing that it's not realistic, that we're going to fight for what we think is realistic. So I'll give you an example. The SRA, just the first clause, all money out of politics on the state and federal level, publicly funded elections. You'd think, who would be opposed to that? Apparently, a lot. A lot of the proposals to overturn Citizens United, to get money out of politics, says we'll let Congress decide how much money they can accept in their elections. Okay, does anybody see a problem with this? Right? In December of 2014, they increased that amount by 500%. So when I talk to national groups about this and say, why are you fighting for something that's not going to get us anywhere? We're going to win if we were to win this. We're going to win this constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United and let Congress decide how much money. And then every 2 years, we're going to be fighting with Congress to minimize that. Okay, if you've just put 10 years into a struggle that you think is actually going to create the change you want and then it doesn't, it's going to make it much harder for you to sustain in the struggle every 2 years. So why not go for what you really want? What's the worst that'll happen? You'll get something less. So the challenge is that when I bring that to these groups, they say, but it's not realistic. So this is why what we're trying to do is raise consciousness and to transform what we believe is realistic. Because as long as what we believe is realistic, is that which those in the power tell us is realistic, we'll never achieve the radical changes that we actually want and need. So if nothing else, putting out a vision that seems unrealistic moves the discourse further towards unrealistic.
Again, thank you, Kat. It's 10:30-ish and time to go. Thank you.
Thank you all so much for having me.